Just as we declare 2015 deceased, I welcome you to LNL on R in Summer. On the face of it, Norway, with its Scandinavian calmness, prosperity, moderate politics, seemed the most unlikely place for a terrorist attack. But in 2011, the country, the world, was shocked when Anders Breivik, a far-right loony, slaughtered 77 people, 69 of them kids, who he hunted down one by one. I'll be talking to Esne Sirestad later on. She's written the definitive account of the event and its aftermath. But first, Gladys, we meet an incredible woman. Christina Lamb first entered Afghanistan 27 years ago, crossing the Hindu Kush with the Mujahideen, the jihadis bankrolled by the Americans to fight the Russians after their invasion. Now, it wasn't long before she fell in love with this fierce country. But for the past 13 years, since 9/11, she's been shocked many times over, watching the West, quote, fight a war with our hands tied, committing too little too late, failing to understand local dynamics, and turning a blind eye as our enemy was helped by our own ally, Pakistan. Over this time, Christina has spoken to all the main decision makers, heads of state, generals. She travelled the length and breadth of Pakistan, all across Afghanistan, including the caves of Tora Bora, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and even Guantanamo Bay. Christina Lamb, OAM, foreign affairs correspondent with the Sunday Times. Her latest book is called Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World. And she was with me in the Sydney studio earlier this year. So I started by asking her what drew her to the region.
I was drawn there because of a wedding, really. I was working at the Financial Times as an intern after I left university. And one day the foreign editor was supposed to go to a lunch of South Asian politicians. And last minute he couldn't go. And he said to me, "You're always going on about India. Why don't you go to this lunch?" So I went and sat next to somebody who was the Secretary General of the Pakistan People's Party. And he said to me, "Would you like to interview Benazir Bhutto, who at that time was living in exile in London?" So, of course, I said yes. Went to interview her in the Barbican in London. And the day that I did the interview was the day that she had announced her engagement to Asif Ali Zardari. So her apartment was full of bouquets of flowers. Anyway, I did that interview. It was my first sort of big interview. I then got a job in TV, local TV, covering sort of flower shows and things like that. Came home from work one day and there was an invitation on my mat, which was to Benazir's wedding in Pakistan. So, of course, I went and it was an amazing introduction to the country. And I was completely fascinated by it and just couldn't imagine going back to reporting local news in Birmingham. So I gave him my notice and went to talk to foreign editors in London of newspapers. And they all said, "We're not interested in Pakistan, but we are interested in Afghanistan." Because at that time, which was 87, the Russians were still in Afghanistan. So I packed my bag and took something called the Flying Coach up the Grand Trunk Road to Peshawar and started going in and out of Afghanistan with the Mujahideen.
A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and of course, memories came rushing back of the helicopters leaving the roof and people desperately trying to climb on board. Your book starts in October last year with the last departure of US troops from Afghanistan, and you explain the last thing they wanted was a replication of that image.
Yes, they tried very, very hard to make sure that there was no repeat of the sort of roofs of Saigon image. It was, in fact, quite specifically told to them. So, and it kept being explained to us, the few journalists that were allowed to cover it, because they really didn't want much coverage, was that this was not a retreat, it was a transition to Afghan forces.
Oh, newspeak. And of course, it was, as you say, the biggest airborne withdrawal since the Berlin airlift.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite spectacular, I have to say, and it was incredibly well organized. So it was quite easy. I mean, that was the intention, I think, to make people focus on that and how incredibly impressive it was to watch all these aircraft coming and going and to forget about what it actually signified, which was that after 13 years of being in Afghanistan with that 140,000 NATO troops and all the most sophisticated weaponry on earth, we had not been able to defeat the Taliban.
The locals viewed the departure of the foreign troops rather equivocally. They didn't really understand why they were going, and they certainly didn't understand the point of killing the Taliban, because as you point out, why kill them when more just kept coming over the borders from Pakistan?
Yes, I mean, initially in southern Afghanistan, the feeling was that really we were in the wrong place. Why were there troops fighting down there and not doing anything at all about the other side of the border where all of these, or many of these people were being trained in madrasas to come and fight? I mean, later on that sort of changed because people became so disillusioned by the Afghan government and felt that it was doing nothing for them and so corrupt that many people then decided that they would rather have the Taliban than they would have the Afghan government, which we were fighting for.
I mentioned your interesting fact that we're talking about the biggest airborne withdrawal since the Berlin airlift. But what I hadn't realised was that by the end of last year, the US had spent more in Afghanistan than it had on the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II. How much?
Yes, it's astonishing. Well, $1 trillion was spent on
$1 trillion.
Afghanistan. And you wouldn't know it, really, if you were to go to, even to Kabul, the capital, you still see lots of people living in very squalid conditions. Only about 10% of people have electricity.
But that's enough money to make every single Afghani a millionaire.
It should have been. Of course, a lot of that money was spent on bringing foreign advisors over who were highly paid. A lot of money was spent on building big military bases. And it cost a lot of money to keep all those soldiers in Afghanistan. I mean, the US was spending $1 million a year per soldier.
It's important to remember that a majority of kids there have only ever known war against the Russians, each other, the West, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. 15,000 Afghan troops died, over 22,000 civilians.
Yes, and I mean, sadly, the figures are going up. Last year, 5,000 Afghan soldiers were killed and about 2,000 civilians were killed. And this year, it looks like the figure's going to be far higher than that. So, I mean, it's hard to sort of portray this as a success when you look at things like that.
More than a military failure, you write, this was a political failure, a lack of imagination caused us to assume people wanted the same thing as us, and that because our enemy were uneducated, they were ignorant savages, we could easily outsmart. They didn't know much about the history of the region.
No, I mean, that's one of the astonishing things when you look at Afghanistan. I mean, the very first night that I arrived in Peshawar in 87, I remember looking out of my hotel window and seeing the mountains silhouetted in the distance and thinking, and beyond that lay Afghanistan. And I thought about all the various people over the centuries who had tried to conquer Afghanistan, Alexander the Great, Babur, the first Mughal emperor, Genghis Khan, and then the British, of course, had been in there three times. So of all people, we should have known. And then the Russians. And yet, you know, people just didn't seem to look at the history. In fact, last year in Herat, I was taken to a place called the Jihad Museum, which a warlord had set up, which is kind of testament to why you should never try and invade Afghanistan. It's sort of all the things that they've captured over time. And they even have a Russian guide to show people around who was captured as a prisoner and ended up staying in Afghanistan.
You described the war on terror as a failure of political narrative. It wasn't explained to people at home. And the reason we failed to beat the Taliban was also political. Why?
Well, I think, I mean, as you mentioned in your last question, I mean, we did not think about what Afghans really wanted. We didn't talk to them. So we went there thinking that we should hold elections as a priority. And when I went through all my notebooks from that time, I realized not a single Afghan I had spoken to had ever mentioned needing elections. Everybody wanted sort of security and jobs. And jobs was one of the things that we really failed to sort of create anything. We focused so much on schools and educating young people and didn't think about what happened afterwards. But I think, you know, why I emphasize the political failings on Afghanistan is I just think that we really didn't know what we were there to do. At the beginning, it was straightforward. It was in reaction to 9/11. And that part was quite quick and successful. Within 60 days, the Taliban regime had been toppled, hadn't cost very much money. It cost about $3.8 billion. And five soldiers were killed, five Americans. But after that, once the Taliban regime had gone, then what were we there for? Were we trying to rebuild Afghanistan? What were we doing there? And people didn't really know and couldn't agree and couldn't explain to their populations in their home countries why they were there. And I think it's very difficult to fight a war if you don't know what you're trying to achieve. And
well,
most
in fact,
of all, we didn't
you introduce
to the Afghans.
Your book, oddly. I found it odd, although now I listen to you, I accept it, with a quote of MacArthur's, General MacArthur. It is fatal to enter any war without the will to win it. You're going even beyond that, saying without even understanding it.
Yes, I do. I mean, you could well argue that we should never have got into a fight with the Taliban. I mean, that wasn't what this was about. We had gone into Afghanistan because of 9/11, which, by the way, was not carried out by Afghans. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis.
The Saudis, yes.
The plot was organised from Pakistan.
Our other allies.
Yes, the plot was organised from Pakistan. There were no Afghans involved. But bin Laden was living in Afghanistan, who had given his blessing to it. So it was all about finding bin Laden and tackling al-Qaeda in revenge for 9/11. And, I think that there was a whole support around the world to do that at the time. But taking on the Taliban was not something that was kind of mentioned at the beginning, and it maybe was something we should never have got involved in doing.
Over 13 years of war, you watched, and I quote, "with growing incredulity, as we fought a war with our hands tied, became distracted by a new war of our own making, based on wrong information, and turned a blind eye as our Taliban enemy was being helped by our ally, Pakistan." Okay, wisdom of hindsight, wrong. How should have we proceeded?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, as I just said, I'm not sure we should ever have got into fighting the Taliban. But certainly, if you go back to having toppled the regime at the end of 2001, what we didn't do was send in any peacekeeping troops. We had just 5,000 troops went into Afghanistan, and they were only allowed in Kabul. And they were, because President Bush said he did not want to get involved in policing Afghanistan, they were described as a stabilization assistance force. They were not described officially as peacekeepers. And this is a country of around 30 million people, much bigger area than Iraq. And we just had 5,000 soldiers in Kabul. Now, I feel very strongly if at the beginning we had had more soldiers around the country, we would not have got into this situation. Because at the beginning, the Afghans welcomed the foreign soldiers. They felt that they had had years and years of civil war, of Afghans fighting Afghans, and that the foreigners would actually help them sort it out. What happened was, aside from the small group of peacekeepers, or not called peacekeepers, in Kabul, there was then around 20,000 American troops called Operation Enduring Freedom, whose job was to try and find the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And those were the people that were traveling around the country, not protecting Afghans, but carrying out raids to try and find people to put in Guantanamo, were not respecting the culture, were going into villages, going into women's quarters, taking dogs, which are regarded in Afghanistan as unclean, bombing wedding parties.
Hence their use in Abu Ghraib.
Yes, absolutely. And generally upsetting people around the country, and also, you know, quite a lot of people got killed in these things. So you had this one group that was sort of destabilizing the country. This group that was supposed to be stabilizing were not allowed outside Kabul. So for the first sort of 5 years, this situation, which was quite ridiculous, continued. And at the same time, the Taliban, who had been toppled, they had gone back to Pakistan. And realized quite quickly, or the Pakistani intelligence realized, that there was no interest in Afghanistan from the outside world of really sort of stabilizing the country. So they started looking at actually mobilizing to go back. And when we got involved in Iraq in 2003, that gave them the perfect opportunity. I mean, I don't argue that things went wrong in Afghanistan because of Iraq. I think that helped. But I actually think even if we hadn't got involved in Iraq, there was not the commitment at the beginning to do things properly in Afghanistan.
Timing is everything. And of course, you and I are having this conversation while the great ripples from the Seymour Hersh piece go around the world, namely that Pakistan and the US collaborated on the mission to kill bin Laden. I know to some extent you anticipated Hersh's views. You suggest something like that in your book.
Well, I mean, I differ with him on this, because I think that, you know, there's no doubt that bin Laden could not have been living in that house in Abbottabad, 70 miles from the capital, just a mile from the country's main military school, without people in charge knowing that he was there. I've been to the house. I went just after he was killed. And that city, Abbottabad, is a complete garrison town. It's military pennants everywhere. Pakistan has a huge military intelligence, ISI. The idea that they did not know he was there is inconceivable. And there are few people really in senior positions in Pakistan that doubt that they knew. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, some people have said, oh, that there's like a bin Laden desk in ISI. I don't think it was like that. I think they're much more sophisticated and subtle. I think it was all done through these various groups that they've cultivated over the years. The whole Pakistan's foreign policy over the years has been using proxies. But where I differ with Seymour Hersh is, well, two things. He says that America found out about bin Laden being there through a walk-in from a tip-off from a Pakistani ISI official to the US embassy in Islamabad. Very difficult to imagine a Pakistani ISI walking into the US embassy in Islamabad, because everything is watched there and it's incredibly monitored. So it would be seen by the authorities.
Unless he went in on a mission.
Well, the person
with approval.
The person that he named actually turns out to be someone who died last year and who hadn't been involved with ISI for years. He'd been living in exile in the UK. But that aside, I mean, this scenario that he creates, that then there was a deal done between the Obama administration and the Pakistanis that they would, the US would carry out this raid, kill Osama, and then announce a few days later that he'd been killed somewhere else in Waziristan, and that they would then have, so that they would not embarrass the Pakistanis, but then they went back on that. It's just inconceivable. I mean, that means so many people would have had to lie about this who were involved that you just can't imagine.
As an interlude, I want to talk about Guantanamo, because as you point out, one of the great mistakes the West made was the detention and subsequent torture of prisoners, some of whom had simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time. And many of them are still in the wrong place, aren't they, at Guantanamo?
Yes, I mean, astonishingly, when Obama took office at the beginning of 2009, the first pledge he made was that he would close Guantanamo, and here we are 6 years on, and it's still there with a couple of hundred people still in it, including around 80 who have been absolutely cleared of anything, but they don't know what to do with them. Very few people have had trials, and it's just created, you know, if you're going to fight this kind of war and claim that you have the moral high ground, you have to be really careful about your own behavior. And I think one of the problems of all of this and all these wars is that there's been this real vague kind of argument of what we're actually doing. Now, part of that is because the enemy that's being fought is a kind of nebulous thing. It's not a state in one place, Al-Qaeda or now ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call it, is, you know, in different places. And so you have to have the freedom to be able to fight in different areas and maybe take the fights like they have done with the drones in a more way that doesn't sort of respect boundaries. But I think you really have to be very careful about this because you end up creating new enemies. And so in Pakistan, the drones are incredibly unpopular and people saw it as a violation of their sovereignty and made Pakistan today, I would say, probably the most anti-American country on earth. And the same way, Guantanamo, all over the Islamic world, people saw what was happening there as an affront to their religion, and it created a sort of recruiting tool for the very people they were trying to fight.
And of course, those images coming out of Abu Ghraib, the appalling, the political pornography, if you like, that flooded out of there.
Absolutely. I mean, everywhere I went at that time in the Middle East, people would complain about it.
Okay, as you probably know, it's very hard for journalists in this country to get into our detention centres, our offshore detention centres. It's made bloody difficult, to the verge of being impossible. There's not actually a red carpet out for people to go to Guantanamo. How did you get there?
Well, I was able to go because they were doing what they call these military commissions, so which is a trial, but it's all a trial where the military are the judge, the jury, the prosecution, the defence. And so they had one of those hearings while I was based in Washington a few years ago. And so I was able to go and listen to that and see it and through that go and visit the prison. You don't get to see everything. You don't get to see the most notorious prison camp X-ray where people, the sort of real bad guys like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, is being held.
My guest, Christina Lamb. Long association with the Middle East conflict zones during her career as a foreign correspondent. Her new book is called Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World. This is Ellie Nell on RN Summer, online, on your mobile. Let's move on a little. How much responsibility do you lay at the feet of the West for the creation of ISIS?
Well,
or whatever we want to call it.
I mean, one of the things I feel quite strongly of going back and forth and covering these conflicts is that we don't seem to know how to end wars. And if you look at what happened in Iraq, you know, we left a big problem there. We left a government that we knew was only really looking after the Shias and not looking after the Sunni minority in Iraq. So we kind of should have made much more effort, having done what we had done in Iraq, and we could talk for a long while about the rights and wrongs of that, but we should have made much more effort to actually leave it with some kind of representative government, and we did not do that. And instead, you know, the in 2003, just after Saddam was toppled, one of the worst mistakes that we made was de-Baathization, which was basically saying anybody that had been in the Ba'ath Party, the ruling party of Saddam Hussein, had to be removed from their positions.
One of the greatest tactical errors.
Yeah,
in
it was ridiculous
history.
Because you could not get a job, really, a senior job, without being in the party. So this meant that all sorts of people, like surgeons and doctors, were losing their jobs. And Paul Bremer, who was the American administrator at the time, also disbanded the Iraqi army, which was 400,000 people. And at the time, I interviewed a lot of the officers of the army, colonels and general, who were absolutely furious. And they were not, or at least they said they were not, great supporters of Saddam. They were people doing their job. They were quite secular people. And they'd been left with no way to earn a living. And yet they were armed and trained. Now, some of those very some of those very people have ended up working with IS as advisors. So the fact that IS came out of nowhere, apparently, a year ago and was able very quickly to take vast swathes of Iraq was very much due to the tactics and military know-how of these people.
I must ask you this. Have you found it an additional difficulty, apart from getting access in the first place, in talking to these characters as a woman?
Oddly, no. I think in a lot of these areas, women journalists, Western women journalists, are regarded as kind of a third sex, some kind of alien species. And so we're able...
Is this true? Or are you from a distant galaxy?
Well, you started off talking about out-of-body experiences. So I think that for us, we're able to go and talk to the men. But we also have a big advantage, which our male colleagues don't have, which is we can go and talk to the women too, which after all is half the population.
Of course.
So I think it's an advantage to be a woman and not a disadvantage.
You visited jihadi training camps in Pakistan, and during this time, about 2003, you observed a change. Many were calling for war at home and suicide bombings started. Pakistan had over 200,000 jihadis, but if you counted all the students at madrasas, the number would have been well over 1 million, perhaps 2 million students. Yet they were ignored by the Americans.
Yes, well, I mean, you can go back, really, right to when the Mujahideen, backed by the Americans and CIA, were fighting the Russians, because at that time, when I was first living in Pakistan and covering Afghanistan, huge amounts of money were being given to the Mujahideen for weapons. And yet, all these refugees that were living in Pakistan, 3.5 million Afghan refugees, were not provided education by the West. And who came in instead, setting up schools, madrasas, were Saudi organizations. And that became a kind of welfare system throughout Pakistan of around 20,000 madrasas that provide free school and free board and lodging. So if you are a poor mother in Karachi with several children, you basically have a choice of sending them to a madrasa where they get everything free, even if it's a kind of warped education, perhaps, or a local school where there might be no teachers because there's so much corruption in Pakistan. And you have to pay for everything. So it really isn't a choice. And I felt that the West should have done much more in trying to help create a secular education system so that people had a choice. We didn't do that.
Christina, the book is so substantial. And I'm not laughing. I'm serious. It's a massive book. And there's an extraordinary story on every damn page. But let's go back to Benazir Bhutto. She had warnings of a plot to kill her if she returned to Pakistan. She insists on returning. You are puzzled, as we all were, I suppose, by the inadequacy of her security. But the Americans and British didn't seem to help, even after the bus she was on had exploded, becoming Pakistan's worst terrorist attack at that time. You tried to investigate her death, and you were, shall we say, discouraged.
Yes, I mean, whoever was behind Benazir's death, you have to look at the facts that within a very short time of her being killed in Rawalpindi, after she'd been speaking at a rally, all the things that were done were so strange. For example, the street around where she was killed was hosed down almost immediately, so all the evidence was removed. Now, when there'd been previous attacks on Pakistan's president, there has been two assassination attempts, streets were sealed for days so that they could meticulously go through every bit of evidence. So that was very odd. Then very quickly they announced that she had been killed by hitting her head on the handle of the roof of her vehicle, which was sort of contrary to some of the things the doctors had been saying. And then, again, very quickly, they produced this strange transcript of somebody called Baitullah Masood from the Pakistan Taliban, apparently having a conversation with someone discussing her assassination and congratulating them on carrying it out. Now, Baitullah Masood was a wanted person. He was the leader of the Pakistan Taliban. The idea that he would be having a conversation on a phone when his predecessors had been caught through phone conversations. Everybody knew that not to use that kind of communication, and having that kind of open conversation just seemed extremely odd. So
it's interesting that for much of the interview, smiles play on your lips as you think of absurdities, ironies, improbabilities.
Well, I suppose I have this kind of love-hate relationship with Pakistan that it sort of, I mean, drives me crazy, the things that have been done there. But you also somehow, I mean, the people are great, and also you have to admire some of the way that things were done. And one of the American generals that I spoke to, who dealt a lot with Pakistan, in fact, he says to me he suffers PTSD as a result of dealing with Pakistan. He said, you know, we Americans congratulated ourselves in that we were playing chess against the Taliban. And what we didn't realize were the Pakistanis were playing chess in 10 dimensions.
Christina Lamb's book is called Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World, and coming up inside the most traumatic event in Norway's recent history. When the massacre occurred in Norway, the world was appalled, but also surprised, because Norway seemed the most unlikely place for such a terrorist attack. A nation of 5 million people, quite low in employment, generous welfare benefits, fighting above its weight around the world in helping people negotiate in out of difficult situations, a welcoming place of refuge for asylum seekers from all parts of the globe, a paragon among nations. So the government building bomb blast, which killed 8 people, and the subsequent massacre of 77, including, let us recall, 69 children by Anders Breivik in July 2011, was a profound shock to Norwegians, because it was carried out, or particularly because it was carried out by one of their own. Now, until this time, Asna Seerstad has focused on foreign places. Her book, The Bookseller of Kabul, was a international bestseller. And you might recall our conversation in 2008 about her Angel of Grozny, after Asna had gone undercover in Chechnya to find out how ordinary people were living. Well, now she's written the definitive account of the life of Breivik, of the massacre, and his trial. And I have to tell you, it is full of astonishments. Her book's called One of Us, The Story of Anders Breivik and the Massacre in Norway. And she joins us from the studios of Radio NRK in Oslo. Welcome back to our Little Wireless program.
Thank you.
When the attack occurred, Norway was ruled by a Labour Party. The Prime Minister at the time responded by saying Norway would not clamp down with a new security state. 2 months later, they voted out. 4 years later, is Norway still reeling from this event?
Definitely. This tragedy will always be part of us now. Every single Norwegian have some memory, a distinctive view on what happened. And of course, this is something we can just not get rid of just like that. But on the whole, I would say that, you know, Norway's fundament, what we stand on, is basically the same. It hasn't changed. So we're not that weak that we'll be just, you know, brushed away by one single terror act.
You know, it's interesting. The Conservative Party won that election after 3 terms of Labour government. And the PM, Solberg, governs in a coalition with the right-wing Progress Party, of which Breivik was a member.
Yeah, that's kind of a paradox, the fact that the victim of the attack, which was the Labour Party, was voted out after the attack. And the Progress Party, who'd never been in government before, was voted in. I think the only reason, the nice reason, you can have the nice reason and you can have a bad reason. The nice reason would be that people did not connect Breivik any longer to this party. After all, the Progress Party, even though it's anti-immigration, it's been warning against Islamization across Europe. It is a party that works within the democratic framework or of the parliamentarian system. But on the other hand, we didn't really discuss the fact that did this party hold ideas that have been ingredients for Breivik's ideology? He took it much longer, but still, some of the bases are the same. But for most people, they voted for this party because of economics, because they didn't want to pay, you know, they wanted less tax and, you know, for the same reasons as Cameron won in the UK. They wanted less tax, less welfare. You know, people are so well off that they don't see that actually there are some people in the society who needs that the welfare state continues.
I hadn't realised that Norway's police response to the events was so inadequate. Let's look at some of them. First of all, let's look at the bombing of the government building. Can you just explain to me what went on? What was the police response when they heard of the bombing?
Yes, it was. That is another tragedy. The second tragedy on that side, the fact that Norwegian police was not up to the task. It really acted as a police force of a failed state. So when the whole government area is attacked, is bombed, no one in the police thinks of this is terror. Could be terror. We should track down the terrorists. So their response is they send in their forces to the government area, but they don't close any roads. They don't set up any observation posts, and they don't. There's one single police helicopter in the whole of Norway, and in July it's on holiday. So it was on the ground, but of course the pilots who knew how to fly that police helicopter, they called in for duty, and they were told, we don't need you. And all this, you know, had the police helicopter been in the air when Breivik was moving slowly towards the island and then later coming on the island.
Let's leave the island for a minute because he arrives at this first crime scene dressed as a cop. He parks his van outside the front of the government offices in an illegal parking spot. A bloke rings the police to report the strange occurrence. He gives an identification as well as the make and model of the vehicle. He gives the rego number. But it was a holiday and no one's on duty.
Well, there are police officers on duty and there are operators, telephone operators, who took that call. And even the operator who took the call about the policeman with a gun in his hand going into a civilian van, and as you said, was given even the, you know, the number plate, she was comparing this to the videos of the, you know, the surveillance videos of the government area, and she realizes this must be the same person. She writes everything down on a yellow post-it note. She walks into the chief of operations hall, and she gives it to her boss, and she gets the impression that the post-it note is being noted. And it's not. So it just lies there on the desk while Breivik is driving slowly out of Oslo. He's standing in a queue under the Opera. You know, we have this Opera tunnel under the fjord. He's passing slowly the American embassy, which is, which is filled with police and security personnel, because everyone thinks this is, directed to from Al-Qaeda or something. And the next target could be the Americans. But the yellow post-it note is on that desk. It disturbs no one. And after almost half an hour, someone realizes this post-it note and they call back to the guy who's done that observation. And he has to repeat it, and precious time is being lost.
Now, because the police did not react, did not install roadblocks, Breivik has time aplenty to drive to the ferry, which was stopped because of the explosion, but his police uniform persuaded them to get it working again. And that's how he gets to the island.
Yes, and of course, there is a great sense of trust in the Norwegian society. That's one of the, you know, positive traits of our society, I would say. So when, a policeman will always, you know, it will give... it will make people trust him. So when he drives up to these young people on the dock, saying, "I'm sent by the special forces in Oslo to inform the people on the island," and he had some, you know, anti-bomb equipment with him. He said, like because he was very loaded with guns and ammunition and all that. And of course, they trusted him and they welcomed him over.
And to be fair, of course, you're talking of a country which had no experience of terrorism. And in a way, you talk about paradox, that was also revealed in the trial. The strange way he was so courteously greeted by the prosecutors and the defence attorneys, allowed to salute.
Well, he wasn't really allowed to salute, but he wasn't denied it either. But I think that there is something good in that trust too, and of course, it makes us vulnerable. But also, most people do not want Norway to turn into a police state. And what happened in the trial? There is a handshake among all members of the trial. That's the rule. So should we change our laws because of him?
Oh, I see, because certainly foreign journalists were quite bewildered by this cordiality, but you're saying it's simply standard protocol. Okay, now, Breivik's plan was to behead kids. I mean, he had this appalling plan in his mind. Who were his intended targets? Who did he see as his enemies? In fact, looking through what you've written, it's hard to see anyone who he didn't see as his enemies.
His enemies are those he called the cultural Marxists. And they would be, you know, most European, Americans, Australians, whoever is not... someone like him who wants to rid our countries of Muslims. Muslims should either be killed, be deported, or they will have to convert. And convert in the way that they will change their names to Christian names, and they will not be able to have any contacts with their Muslims' relatives in their home countries. All mosques will be demolished, burnt, and so on. So his ideology is actually the same in a way like ISIS, just like it's Christian, not Muslim. So he wants a pure state, Christian, chaste, pure state. So anyone who doesn't support him is looked upon as being cultural Marxist. And the Labour Party youth who run this island, and they meet there every year, and it's a very strong symbol of also, you know, community, solidarity, working together. It's kind of a, you know, happy summer holiday, political summer camp for kids. But of course, within a political framework. So his plan was to scare them enough so that they will run away and drown in the waters, all 600 of them. Luckily, he was not able to get them all. But one of the other main targets of his was the former prime minister, Gro Harlem Brundtland, the first female politicians we had, or strong politician we had, prime minister all through his upbringing. His plan was to behead her and film it while she confessed of being a traitor and send it up, you know, download it and send it on YouTube. She was able to leave the island before he got there because he was delayed. So the most efficient way for him to kill people was to shoot them in the head.
Your sources for the book come from his diaries, his blogs, court testimonies, interviewing hundreds of family members and victims. And although he testified to being initially reluctant to shoot, once he started, he clearly enjoyed himself, because the kids were often not just shot once, but over and over and over again. I mentioned Thomas Jefferson playing a part. Would you please tell us about his repetitions of that Jeffersonian quote?
Yeah, the quote is that every
country the tree of liberty must be refreshed exactly. From time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
Yes, exactly. So that's a quote that he had several times in his manifesto. And it says a bit about his rhetorics. He takes a quote, you know, from a fine man, and he takes it and distorts it into terror and violence and being totally literal about these young people having to pay for what he says is destroying Norway, which is immigration. And this is considering we don't have much immigration in Norway. And on the average, we have, when it comes to the Muslim population in Europe, there's an average of 6%. In Norway, we have 3% Muslims. So it's like he doesn't really respond to a huge problem in the society. So I think that there were many things, like, why did he do it? Of course, his own explanations is to rid Norway and then Europe of Muslims. But I think there's many also psychological reasons. He had a hatred of women, of feminists. He blamed feminists for the waves of immigration that he called it, because the feminists had feminized the European man.
Going back to his declaration of war posted on the internet just before the bomb exploded, and that Jefferson quote, it wasn't an entirely original document, was it? It was recycled or plagiarized.
Definitely. It's cut and paste. He put the sources, he puts, the names like Robert Spencer, Pamela Geller, the Norwegian ideologue Fjordman, are those that he used most extensively. He usually put their names. Other times he just writes it into his own text. But it's definitely a manifesto which is very confusing, often contradictory also, when it comes to Nazism, fascism, for instance. Sometimes he's reporting the fascists, the historical fascists in Germany. Other times he's very against them because he's pro-Israel. So it's like it's going very much back and forth. It is a confused work. And it's the third part, which is his own, that's where he explains in detail how to make the bomb and how he did it.
I sort of vaguely recall that some of the cut and pasting originated from documents written in Australia by ultra-right wingers, but okay. I know it's a cliche to blame his mother, but she did have great difficulty with mothering, didn't she? And there were missed opportunities here when authorities wanted to retrieve him from his home.
Yeah, it is. Of course, the mother had her own problems. So to blame her, I agree with you. It is a cliche. And what about the father who just left them? He's usually, you know, not being blamed. But yes, let's talk about the mother. She's definitely the important figure of his childhood. And she is very unstable, both as a mother and as she told me later, late in life, just before she died last year, she said, you know, I wasn't fit to be a mother. I wasn't up to the task. She's an abused child herself, sexually abused. And I think, and she said also like her problems or his problems were probably came from her own problems. But she talked in, you know, in not very clearly about these things. But anyway, she was the kind of mother who would go out in the evenings and she would leave the kids at home. There was a half-sister in the picture too, and just come home in the morning. There were lots of men coming in and out. Neighbors thought she was a prostitute at times. Then she calmed down, but then she had a psychological breakdown and the whole family was in for observation at the clinic for child and adolescent psychiatry in Oslo. And the clear recommendation after 1 month there was that Anders should be taken away from his mother because he came in as a child who didn't smile, he didn't cry, he didn't play, he took no interest in toys, he avoided contact with grown-ups. But after this, you know, a couple of weeks into that month, he was totally behaving like a normal boy. And they were like realizing that there was nothing wrong with him as such, but it was the destructive relationship to the mother that was his problem. So they wrote prophetically in a way, if this child is not under better cares, is not put in a better care situation, we are fearing serious abnormality in his development.
Asnay, why did he decline to be interviewed by you? Was this another manifestation of his misogyny?
Well, I think it's again this fear of intimacy, one thing, fear of being looked in the neck in a way, or looked in the eyes too. The fact that in the trial, there were two things he avoided all the time. His childhood, the relationship to his mother, and his relationship to women. These are the three things he did not want to talk about. And when it comes to politics, he felt on safe ground. When it came to his actions, his bomb-making, his terror act, he was on safe ground. So it's like in an interview, of course, he's afraid of being, to be humiliated, to be small, to be weak.
On our next, how the smile caused a revolution in 18th century France and the quirks and contradictions of communist architecture. Stick around on RN for the news and we'll see you later.